Good morning, everybody. I must say, by way of introduction, that I was actually intending at first to talk about something quite different today. But I decided that it might take me back onto the same sort of territory that I was talking about on Wednesday, and perhaps it would be good to have a change. So instead, I want to talk about this little book of Habakkuk, which I do both because I think it's a very interesting book, very satisfying, but also because its subject is one that I think is very apposite to the world that we and the times that we live in. Its fundamental concern is for justice in the world, or rather the lack of it. And not so much as in Job, the question of justice as experienced by individuals, but rather, as I said, in justice in the world at large. We're all aware of the kind of world that we live in with its problems. We all know that the degree to which it's marked by inequality, by oppression, by injustice, the collapse of the moral order, the domination by bullying great powers, and behind all of that, such things as, of course, climate change. Now, Habakkuk takes us back, though, into a very different world on the face of it. Takes us back to the time of the reign of King Jehoiakim, about 600 or so BC, not very long before the conquest of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar. And as you've heard in the reading this morning, it begins with Habakkuk complaining to God, crying out to God about the chaotic state of Judah, in which he sees nothing but crime, perversion of justice, and violence. Verse 3, he says, "Why do you make me see iniquity? Why do you look idly at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arise, so the law is paralyzed and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, so justice goes forth perverted." It's obvious that the reforms of his father Josiah have had only a very superficial effect. And so Habakkuk asks, "Why do you let these things happen? This is supposed to be your land. Why is there nothing but injustice and evil and violence?" And he gets an answer which occupies verses 5 to 11. And the first thing that God does in his answer is to admit that it's a strange answer. Verse 5, he says, "Be astonished, be astounded, for a work is being done in your days that you would not believe if you were told." It's a surprising and a shocking thing that he then goes on to announce. What he foretells is the coming of a terrible enemy, the Chaldeans, Babylonians, Nebuchadnezzar. And that's shocking, profoundly shocking to Habakkuk, and God knows it is, because this is no improvement on the present state of affairs. This is something worse, something much, much worse, terrible catastrophe. And so you see how the Chaldeans are described, verse 6. "Behold, I'm raising up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, who march through the breadth of the earth to seize dwellings not their own. They are dreaded and fearsome. Their justice and dignity go forth for themselves." In other words, they make the rules for themselves. "Their horses are swifter than leopards, more fierce than the evening wolves," and so on. A terrible predatory aggressor. And Habakkuk is completely dumbfounded. He says something like, "God is supposed to be just, isn't he? God's supposed to hate evil. So how can he tolerate the aggression and the violence of Babylon and the other great powers?" See what he says in verse 13, "Your eyes are too pure to behold evil, and you cannot look on wrongdoing. Why do you look on the treacherous and are silent when the wicked swallow those more righteous than they?" I'm reminded of John McEnroe's immortal words, if you can remember back that far. You can't be serious. It's as if that's what God, he's replying to God. You can't mean that. That's terrible. And his complaint then goes on from verse 12. Are you not from everlasting, O Lord? You know, what is this? And the chapter ends with a question that arises, I suspect, within us too, when we contemplate the history of the world and of nations. He says, is he then, that's the Babylonians, is he then to keep on emptying his net and destroying nations without mercy? It's as if Habakkuk's saying, is that it then? Is there no other solution then for war and oppression and violence? Just more of the same? He's actually saying, has God no better solution than that? One that matches his reputation for justice and mercy? And I must say that for me, at least, that's a very real question, both for now and for the reading of biblical history. And I'm surprised that we don't ask that question ever, that we're so dutifully read that we don't ever question or are not surprised. Was there not another way? Is a question I find myself asking often. So chapter one ends with a kind of challenge, almost a kind of inviting God to justify himself. And he says, right, now, I'm going to wait for an answer now. So he sets himself up like a kind of watchman, as he says, I will take my stand at my watchpost and station myself on the tower and look out to see what he will answer me and what I will answer concerning my complaint. And he does get an answer. But again, the answer is surprising. Surprising in a number of ways, but firstly in the fact that what he gets is not so much a message to transmit to his contemporaries. This message is to be written down, or more precisely engraved on tablets of stone, to be easily read, not to pass away. It's not only for this generation, in other words, this is permanent. This is for now and for the future. And as he says in verse, God says in verse 3, verse 4, yes, verse 3, it's got to be waited for. The vision awaits its appointed time. If it seems slow, wait for it, he says. So that reassurance that comes there is then confirmed by what verse 4 says at the end. The righteous shall live by his faith. In other words, you are going to need to trust. And if you trust in what I'm saying, you will live. And that, of course, is the phrase that Paul seizes upon in the New Testament and sees it as the epitome of the gospel. The righteous will live by their faith. But that's not really the message itself. The real message, the heart of it, comes halfway through the chapter, something like halfway through, in verse 14, where the Lord says, for the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. In other words, despite the impression created by chapter one that world history is nothing but an endless series of kingdoms and states and empires which contrive to achieve supremacy for a time and dominate all other nations, that endless sequence is actually not endless. There is going to be a time when God will exert his authority, will reveal himself in the fullness of his power and the fullness of his grace and of his goodness. As the waters cover the sea, so complete will be the knowledge of God and his good qualities of mercy and kindness will hold sway in the world. That means, of course, that all the striving after power of the likes of Nebuchadnezzar and all his successors right down to the present day, all this endless human striving for power, to achieve power and dominance over other people, it's all fundamentally in vain. They may achieve power for a time, but every empire is doomed to pass. They're all of short duration, partly because human beings are mortal anyway, but also because they provoke in other people a competing desire for power, or at least a desire for freedom. So sooner or later, every empire falls. And, says God, that is the will of God. Verse 13, Habakkuk says, "Is it not from the Lord of hosts that peoples labor merely for fire and nations weary themselves for nothing?" All Nebuchadnezzar's efforts, all Julius Caesar's efforts, all, well, I don't need to name any more names, do I? But all of that is really for nothing. Now, in the light of that declaration, the rest of chapter 2 consists of a series of five woes addressed to people of that ilk, those who seek power, those who seek riches at the expense, of course, of others. Now, it may be that specific individuals are being referred to. I mean, it's pretty likely that Jehoiakim is one of them, and Nebuchadnezzar is pretty certainly another one. But I think essentially they're typical figures, leaving us to recognize their types, the parallels in the modern world. And you could all, I'm sure if I asked you could all name people to whom these descriptions fit. But just look at them. First one, verse 6. "Woe to him who heaps up what is not his own." Or again, verse 9. "Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, to set his house, his nest on high, to be safe from the reach of harm." Or verse 12. "Woe to him who builds a town with blood and founds a city on iniquity." That's probably Jehoiakim, that one. Or verse 15. "Woe to him who makes his neighbors drink." And so on. And the last one, verse 19, "Woe to him who says to a wooden thing, awake, to a silent stone, arise." Now, there's one very interesting thing about this chapter, it seems to me. It puts an entirely different perspective upon the things that are said in chapter one. Babylon, I'm sure, is one of those to whom to whom these woes are addressed, perhaps even the model for all of them. So you have to look again at back at chapter one. Can God both, as it apparently says in chapter five, positively stir up the Babylonians, actually employ them, agree with their conquest of Jerusalem, kill thousands, take thousands captive? Can God really say, "That's my work, I'm behind that," and then in the next chapter pronounce woes against them for their actions? Seems to me there's a profound contradiction if one thinks about it. And it seems to me that the answer is that what God says in chapter one is not so much that he is actually inciting the Babylonians to do it. They need no incitement. They're pretty good at it anyway. What he does do is simply allow them, permit them. You remember what Paul says in Acts twice? He says hitherto he has allowed the nations to go their own way. Let's them do what they want. Or in Romans 1, I'm sure I've said this before three times over, he says that God has handed mankind over to do its own thing, and that is its judgment. Our judgment is the world that we create with all its oppression and its unrighteousness and its problems. We do it. And all God needs to do is to just let people do their thing, and they will do more than he would wish to do as for the world's own chastening. Now, God knows all that, hence he's able to prophesy. And he's able also, of course, to exert his protecting hand where he wills. And for the most part, he's extended it to Israel. And what Habakkuk, I think, is saying to Habakkuk is that when I take my hand away, then Israel becomes a mere plaything tossed about between the great powers in their quest for domination. Anyway, at the end, by the end of chapter 2, we have, as it were, God's essential answer to the complaint that Habakkuk has made in chapter 1. So then in chapter 3, we see Habakkuk responding. We see now how he will answer God's answer. And what he does, I think, in chapter 3 is to imagine what it will be like when God does intervene in this world. He wants it to come quickly, now. But he also wants God to be merciful when it does. And so you find him saying in verse 2, "In our own time, revive it. In our own time, make it known. In wrath, may you remember mercy." Now, the "it" that he's referring to there is what has happened in the past. As verse 1, I think, he talks about your work in the midst of the years, revive it. So he's asking God to do again what he has done in the past and what he knows about. It reminds you of, by the way, that plea for mercy reminds one of Malachi. You remember when Malachi, having talked about the coming of the Lord, says, "But who can endure the day of his coming?" So from verse 3, then, we have a kind of vision of a sort of rerun of Israel's, God's, progress through the wilderness from Egypt into their land. This is God marching with his people towards the land. Verse 13 says, "You came forth to save your people," that's Israel, "to save your anointed. You crushed the head of the wicked house." And there is the answer, of course, to all Habakkuk's questions and doubts. There's going to be a kind of a rerun of those events, with not in detail, but in principle. Verse 16 is a difficult verse, if you just have a look at that. He says he feels a sense of terror at the prospect of God acting in this way. "I hear and my body trembles, my lips quiver at the sound, rottenness enters into my bones, my legs tremble beneath me." It's Malachi's question, who can endure the day of his coming? And then he says, "Yet I will quietly wait for the day of trouble." Now, this verse is ambiguous. Some translations think that says, as my version does here, trouble to come upon people who invade us. Other versions suggest that the trouble is the invasion coming upon us. But in the end, it doesn't make much difference, because the two events are closely interrelated. And what, in any case, Habakkuk has to do is to wait. Let it happen, because it will happen. So what he must do is allow time and history to pass over him, but let the storms pass and wait in faith until it's completed. And then he finishes with those extraordinary verses 17 and 18. He depicts a world in which there is no prospect of new life, in which all life has perished. The fig tree doesn't blossom anymore. There are no fruit on the vine. The olive fails, the fields yield no fruit. Similarly with the animals, the flock will be cut off from the fold. There will be no herd in the stalls. There is no prospect for the future, apparently. And it might get as bad as that, he's implying. Yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. So even then, even in the worst of circumstances, he is full of joy and believes that God is able to renew and bring you life where there was none. Now, those two disciples who went on the road to Emmaus, they were people for whom all hope apparently had gone, just like this. This wonderful, good, wise man whom they'd known, whose coming seemed to herald a better world, who talked about the coming of God's benevolent reign, he'd been destroyed by Jewish envy and by the brutal Roman power. Roman, the very epitome of ruthless striving after power. The bully boys have won again. They've destroyed the last hope. That must be how those two were feeling. Now, the evening before his death, Jesus, and that's the man, of course, had revealed that he was really familiar with the nature of the world. He knew exactly what it's like. But he'd enunciated a totally different principle. This is Luke chapter 22. The disciples, as was their wont, were disputing who should be the greatest. The lust for power is alive and well, not only among the great powers, but right down into the everyday relationships of human beings. And so Jesus says to them, the kings of the Gentiles, that means of the nations, exercise lordship over them, and those in authority over them are called benefactors. Believe it if you will. But not so with you. Rather, let the greatest among you become as the youngest, and the leader as one who serves. For who is the greater, one who reclines at table or one who serves? Is it not the one who reclines at table? No, but I am among you as the one who serves. So Jesus, as I say, knew exactly how the world works. But in face of that, he speaks of service and humility. And he doesn't do it just in words. He enacts it. He performs it. And he allows the powerful to destroy him. But God vindicated him. God declared that he was right and they were wrong. He judged for Jesus and his way, and he judged against the others and the principle by which they live. So ambition, the quest for power are condemned, and it's confirmed in the resurrection of Jesus to vanity and ultimate pointlessness. Now, as I said, that quest, that desire for power, is not just confined to people like Nebuchadnezzar. It's present in all of us, in greater or lesser measure. And in the resurrection, God has shown that he is the one who gives life to the dead and calls into existence the things that do not exist. The fig tree may not blossom. My body doesn't feel exactly as it used to. I dare say all of us feel that we're no longer as we were. But in the way of Jesus is the germ of life, of true life, of new life in his resurrection. Remember the words that Paul writes in 1 Corinthians, where he says, God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are. So our breaking of bread is a time when we have to think of Jesus speaking in that way about what the world is like and what his principle is and what he is going to do. And if we sit at the table with him and take his bread and his wine, what we're actually doing is agreeing with him. We're agreeing with his judgment against power seeking and his judgment for humility and service. The things that he spoke about, the things that he enacted, those things he's saying must be our guide to life, a guide in the way that we spend our time, long or short. And we pray that he will help us to realize the things that we are saying now.